A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's pointing out something that's always bugged me about how people talk about mental health treatment. There's this unspoken assumption that therapy and medication are two lanes. But the actual question here cuts deeper. Can psychotherapy, done well and over time, reduce or even eliminate the need for medication? And is there a recognized model where medication acts as a kind of stabilization bridge, training wheels essentially, that lets someone do the deeper therapeutic work they couldn't manage while acutely symptomatic?
This is one of those questions where the clinical reality and the public perception have drifted miles apart. The short answer to the first part, can therapy reduce medication dependence, is yes. But the mechanism is more interesting than most people realize, and the training wheels metaphor is both useful and dangerously incomplete.
Start with the yes. What does the evidence actually look like?
The landmark work here goes back decades, but the big meta-analyses that really settled the question started appearing in the late 2000s and early 2010s. Queech Purs and colleagues, he's at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam, probably the most prolific psychotherapy analyst alive, have published multiple reviews showing that combined treatment outperforms either medication or psychotherapy alone for moderate to severe depression. The effect sizes aren't subtle. We're talking about a Cohen's D of roughly 0.3 to 0.5 for the additive benefit of combining treatments versus either alone.
For the listener who didn't spend their weekend reading statistical methodology papers,
a Cohen's D of 0.3 is a small but clinically meaningful effect. 5 is medium. You'd notice it in a patient's life. For context, the effect of antidepressants over placebo in most depression trials hovers around 0, so adding therapy to medication gives you roughly the same bump as adding medication to nothing. It's not trivial.
Combined treatment is better. That's the first rung. But the question is about whether therapy can eventually let you climb down off the medication ladder entirely.
Right. And this is where the research gets really specific. There's a body of work on what's called sequential treatment. The idea is, you start with the acute phase, medication gets someone stabilized, and then you introduce psychotherapy, often cognitive therapy or CBT, specifically with the goal of preventing relapse, and in many cases tapering the medication.
Who pioneered this?
Giovanni Fava in Italy has been the name most associated with this for 30 years. He developed something called well-being therapy, but the broader framework he pushed was sequential treatment. His team published a series of randomized controlled trials. The most cited one is probably the 2004 study in the American Journal of Psychiatry, where they took patients who'd responded to antidepressants, randomized them to either continue medication or receive cognitive behavioral treatment while tapering, and followed them for 6 years.
That's not a quick survey of undergrads.
No, this was the real thing. And at the 6-year follow-up, the CBT group had a relapse rate of 40% compared to 90% in the clinical management group. That's not a rounding error. That's a complete inversion of outcomes.
90% relapse versus 40. So the medication-only approach, over a long enough timeline, starts looking almost palliative rather than curative.
That's exactly the language Fava used. He argued that antidepressants in recurrent depression were acting more as suppressive agents than curative ones. You're keeping symptoms at bay, but you're not changing the underlying vulnerability. And this gets at something important about the mechanism. Antidepressants, SSRIs especially, they modulate serotonin signaling, they promote neurogenesis in the hippocampus over time, they do real biological work. But they don't teach you how to interpret your thoughts differently. They don't restructure the cognitive schemas that Beck identified as the engine of depressive thinking. They don't give you behavioral activation skills.
The bridge metaphor, medication as training wheels, does that hold up?
It holds up to a point, and then it breaks. Here's where it's useful. For someone with severe melancholic depression who can barely get out of bed, the idea that they're going to do meaningful cognitive restructuring is fantastical. They can't concentrate. Their executive function is shot. The medication lifts the floor enough that they can engage. That part is true and well documented.
Where does it break?
It breaks because training wheels come off and then you just ride the bike. The implication is that once therapy has done its work, you're cured. You don't need anything anymore. But what the sequential treatment literature actually shows is more nuanced. Some people do fully discontinue medication and stay well. Others reduce their dose or switch to intermittent use. And a significant minority, maybe 25-30%, end up back on medication despite good therapy. It's not a failure of the model, it's that depression is heterogeneous.
This is where I want to poke at something. When you say depression is heterogeneous, that's the polite clinical way of saying we're lumping a dozen different conditions under one label and then acting surprised when they don't all respond the same way.
I mean, yes. That's the dirty secret of DSM-style diagnosis. Two people can both meet criteria for major depressive disorder and share zero symptoms. One has insomnia, weight loss, and agitation. The other is hypersomnic, gaining weight, and leaden. They're almost certainly different biological processes, and that matters enormously for the therapy versus medication question. There's a line of research. Actually, the Rubas and colleagues at Penn have done interesting work here, suggesting that patients with certain baseline characteristics respond differentially. People with more severe depression, more chronic depression, melancholic features, or a history of childhood trauma. They tend to show a larger advantage for combined treatment over monotherapy. The trauma piece is especially interesting.
Why would trauma history predict differential response?
The leading hypothesis is that early adversity produces lasting changes in stress reactivity, HPA axis dysregulation, basically, that makes someone more biologically vulnerable to depression. Medication can dampen that reactivity pharmacologically, but it doesn't process the memories or restructure the meaning the person made of those experiences. Only therapy does that. So, you get a situation where drugs plus therapy are genuinely synergistic. They're working on different parts of the problem.
This is making me think about the anxiety side of the question. The prompt mentioned SSRIs specifically, and SSRIs are first line for anxiety disorders too. Does the combined treatment literature look different for anxiety?
For anxiety disorders, the evidence for psychotherapy alone is actually stronger relative to medication than it is for depression. CBT for panic disorder, for specific phobias, for OCD. The effect sizes are large, and the relapse rates after therapy ends are lower than after medication discontinuation. There's a reason NICE guidelines in the UK recommend CBT as first line for most anxiety disorders, with medication as an adjunct or alternative.
For anxiety, the argument that therapy might eliminate the need for medication is even stronger.
Yes, with a caveat. For OCD specifically, the standard of care is often high-dose SSRIs plus exposure and response prevention therapy. The combination outperforms either alone, and many patients need ongoing medication even with excellent therapy. But for something like panic disorder, a solid course of CBT, 12 to 16 sessions, produces panic-free status in maybe 70 to 80% of patients, and most of them stay well without medication.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about sequential treatment and tapering. Is there a recognized protocol for this? If I'm a clinician and I have a patient who's stabilized on an SSRI and wants to try coming off while doing therapy, do I have an evidence-based roadmap?
This is where the field is frustratingly underdeveloped. There are protocols. Fava's group published step-by-step approaches, but they haven't been manualized and disseminated the way, say, CBT or IPT have been. Most clinicians are improvising. The general principles are taper very slowly, much more slowly than the standard 4 to 6 week discontinuation schedule. We're talking months, sometimes a year or more for patients on high doses or long durations. Introduce the psychotherapy before you start the taper, not during. And use therapy sessions to monitor for prodromal symptoms.
Prodromal symptoms, early warning signs.
The idea is that therapy trains the patient to recognize the earliest cognitive and behavioral signs of a relapse. The sleep change, the rumination pattern, the social withdrawal, and intervene with targeted skills before it becomes a full episode. This is one of the things mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was specifically designed for. MBCT was developed by Seagal, Williams, and Teasdale in the late 90s and early 2000s, explicitly as a relapse prevention intervention for people with recurrent depression.
The evidence for MBCT specifically.
The original 2000 study in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology showed that for patients with three or more prior episodes, MBCT reduced relapse rates by about 50% over a 60-week follow-up compared to treatment as usual. Subsequent analyses have confirmed this. Kaiken and others have shown that MBCT is roughly as effective as maintenance antidepressants for preventing relapse, and for some subgroups it outperforms.
We have a therapy that can substitute for maintenance medication. That's directly on point for the question.
It is, and it's worth noting that MBCT isn't doing the same thing as CBT. CBT is about challenging and restructuring thoughts. MBCT is about changing your relationship to thoughts, recognizing them as mental events rather than accurate reflections of reality. It's a different mechanism, and for relapse prevention specifically, it seems to be the mechanism that matters.
This connects to something I've wondered about. If the goal is eventually reducing or eliminating medication, does the type of therapy matter? Are some modalities better at creating durable, medication-free outcomes?
The honest answer is that we don't have great head-to-head comparisons with long-term medication discontinuation as the endpoint. The sequential treatment studies mostly used CBT or well-being therapy. MBCT has the relapse prevention data. But if you look at the broader psychotherapy outcome literature, the superiority of any one bona fide therapy over another is small to non-existent. This is the so-called dodo bird verdict. What seems to matter more is therapist competence, therapeutic alliance, and whether the therapy is delivered with fidelity.
The dodo bird verdict. Everybody has won and all must have prizes.
That's exactly the reference from Alice in Wonderland, and Saul Rosenzweig coined it in 1936. It's been debated for almost a century. The common factors: alliance, empathy, a coherent rationale, a set of procedures both parties believe in. These seem to account for more outcome variance than the specific techniques.
Which is either deeply reassuring or mildly depressing, depending on how much you've invested in your particular brand of therapy.
I think it's both. It means the field's theoretical disputes are less clinically important than we pretend. But it also means that when you're looking for a therapist, the modality matters less than whether this particular person gets you and knows what they're doing.
Let me play skeptic for a moment. All this evidence about combined treatment and sequential tapering, it's almost entirely from research settings, highly selected patients, expert therapists, close supervision, no insurance constraints. How much of this translates to the clinic down the street?
This is the implementation gap, and it's real. The effect sizes in community settings are smaller. Therapists in routine practice are less likely to use structured protocols, less likely to measure outcomes session by session, and more likely to drift from evidence-based techniques. There's a whole literature on therapist drift and the tapering piece. Most psychiatrists simply don't have the time or training to do the kind of slow, psychotherapy-integrated taper that the research describes.
We have an evidence base that says, yes, this works, and a delivery system that says, good luck finding it.
That's not unfair, though I'd add that the situation is better in some healthcare systems than others. The UK's Improving Access to Psychological Therapies program, IAPT, has trained thousands of therapists in evidence-based protocols and made CBT and other therapies available in primary care. It's not perfect, but it's a real-world implementation at scale. And they've published outcome data showing recovery rates around 50%, which is in line with what you'd expect from the research literature.
50% recovery. That's both impressive and humbling.
And it's worth sitting with what recovery means in these data sets. Typically, it's defined as moving below the clinical threshold on a symptom measure like the PHQ-9 or GAD-7. It doesn't necessarily mean the person is thriving. It means they're no longer in the clinical range. There's a whole separate conversation about what mental health looks like beyond symptom reduction.
That might be a topic for another day. But I want to pull on one thread before we move on. The prompt mentioned the stabilization bridge idea, that medication creates conditions where therapy becomes possible. Is there research that actually tests that mechanism? Not just combined is better, but specifically, medication enables therapy engagement, which then drives outcomes.
There's indirect evidence. Studies looking at CBT for depression find that early symptom improvement, whether from medication or therapy itself, predicts better ultimate outcomes. The logic is that reduced symptom severity improves cognitive capacity and motivation, which enables fuller engagement with therapy. But the direct mediational studies, the ones that formally test whether medication's effect on outcomes flows through increased therapy engagement, are sparse.
We're inferring the mechanism more than proving it.
Though there's a clever study design that gets at this indirectly. Some trials have compared starting medication and therapy simultaneously versus starting medication first and adding therapy after a delay. The delayed start designs generally find that the sequential approach, stabilize first, then add therapy, produces equivalent or sometimes better long-term outcomes than starting everything at once. It's not definitive proof of the bridge hypothesis, but it's consistent with it.
What about the reverse direction? Does therapy ever make medication work better?
There's some evidence for that, too. A 2014 study by Philippi and colleagues. Actually, let me be more precise. There's work showing that psychotherapy can increase prefrontal control over limbic reactivity, which is basically the neural pathway that antidepressants also target. So you could be getting a double hit on the same circuit. Therapy strengthens top-down regulation through practice and learning. Medication boosts the same system through serotonin and neuroplasticity. They're complementary mechanisms converging on the same neural target.
That's a much more satisfying model than pills fix chemicals. Therapy fixes thoughts.
It is, and it's also more accurate. The old chemical imbalance theory, serotonin deficiency causes depression, has been largely abandoned by serious researchers. We know SSRIs work, but we don't fully know why, and the simplistic versions we told patients for 20 years were marketing as much as science.
The serotonin hypothesis as marketing. That's a spicy take.
I'm not saying it's wrong that serotonin is involved. It clearly is. But the idea that depression is simply low serotonin that SSRIs top up, that was never well supported and the field has moved on. The current thinking involves neuroplasticity, neuroinflammation, HPA axis dysfunction, and network level changes in the brain. SSRIs promote neurogenesis and increase BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which essentially makes the brain more plastic and receptive to change. And that's where therapy comes in. If medication is making the brain more malleable, therapy is providing the structured experiences that shape that malleability in healthy directions.
The bridge metaphor might be backwards. Medication isn't just holding you up until therapy can teach you to ride. Medication is tilling the soil so therapy's seeds can grow.
That's a better metaphor, and it aligns with the neurobiological data. There's a fascinating study from 2010 by Carlson and colleagues in Science. They showed that fluoxetine, which is Prozac, reinstates a critical period of plasticity in the adult mouse visual cortex. Critical periods are developmental windows when the brain is especially sensitive to experience. The implication is that SSRIs might be reopening windows of plasticity that allow therapeutic learning to have a bigger impact.
That is a wild finding. Adult mice getting a developmental do-over from Prozac.
It's been replicated and extended. There's work on fear extinction learning, the laboratory model of exposure therapy, showing that SSRIs enhance it. So if you're doing exposure therapy for anxiety or processing trauma, the medication might literally be helping your brain learn the new safety memory more effectively.
This makes me think about the tapering question differently. If medication is enhancing plasticity and therapy is providing the learning, then the ideal sequence might be medication plus therapy during the active phase, then gradual medication reduction while continuing therapy or booster sessions to consolidate the gains. Does that match what the clinical trials show?
That's essentially the FAVA sequential model, and yes, it's the best supported approach we have. The key insight is that you don't want to withdraw medication abruptly or in isolation. The therapy needs to be in place before, during, and after the taper, and the taper needs to be slow enough that any emerging symptoms are caught early.
Define slow enough. What does the evidence say about taper speed?
There's no universal standard, but the data on discontinuation symptoms suggest that the standard 4-week taper is too fast for many patients. The 2019 systematic review in The Lancet Psychiatry by Davies and Reed found that about half of patients experience withdrawal symptoms when stopping antidepressants, and about half of those rate the symptoms as severe. The incidence is higher with shorter tapers and with drugs that have shorter half-lives. Paroxetine and venlafaxine are the worst offenders.
Paroxetine. That's Paxil.
and venlafaxine is Effexor. Both have reputations for brutal withdrawal. Fluoxetine, with its long half-life, is much gentler. Some clinicians will actually switch patients from a short half-life drug to fluoxetine before tapering, specifically to reduce withdrawal severity.
That's a clever workaround. Use the pharmacology against itself.
It's good clinical practice, but it's underutilized. Most patients are never told about this option.
I want to zoom out for a moment. We've established that combined treatment is better, that sequential treatment with therapy during tapering reduces relapse, and that the neurobiological rationale is plausible and partially supported. But the prompt asked a practical question. Is there evidence that therapy can reduce or eliminate the need for medication? What's the bottom line on how often that actually happens?
The honest answer is, it depends heavily on the condition, the patient, and the quality of therapy. For a first episode of moderate depression in someone without a strong family history or childhood trauma, a course of CBT or IPT without medication produces remission rates comparable to medication alone, roughly 50 to 60%, and the relapse rate after therapy ends is lower than after medication discontinuation. For that person, therapy might well eliminate the need for medication entirely.
At the other end of the spectrum,
for someone with recurrent severe depression, melancholic features, multiple prior episodes, and a strong family loading, that person may need ongoing medication indefinitely, and the role of therapy is to improve functioning and quality of life rather than to replace the medication. There's nothing wrong with that. The goal isn't to be medication-free as some kind of purity test. The goal is to be well.
That's worth underlining. There's a weird moral valence that sometimes attaches to being medication-free, as if taking an SSRI is a characterological failure rather than a medical treatment.
It's pervasive, and it does real harm. I've had patients who felt ashamed of their medication, who saw it as a crutch or a sign of weakness. The stigma around psychotropic medication is an artifact of the mind-body dualism that still haunts medicine.
The ghost of Descartes, still messing with our heads.
The idea that mental disorders are somehow less real or less medical than physical ones, it's philosophically incoherent and clinically damaging. And it leads to exactly the false dichotomy the prompt identified, therapy versus medication, as if they're opposing teams rather than complementary tools.
If we were going to summarize the evidence for someone who's trying to make a decision, maybe they're on an SSRI, they're stable, they're wondering whether therapy could help them eventually reduce or stop the medication, what would we tell them?
I'd say, the evidence supports giving it a try, but with some important conditions. First, find a therapist who's trained in an evidence-based modality, CBT, IPT, MBCT, behavioral activation, and who has experience working with patients who are tapering medication. Second, don't rush the taper. Third, have a plan for what to do if symptoms return. And fourth, be open to the possibility that the best outcome might be a lower dose, not zero medication.
That fourth point seems crucial. The binary, on medication or off medication, is probably too crude for how this actually works in practice.
There's a concept in the literature called lowest effective dose. The idea is that for maintenance treatment, you might not need the full acute treatment dose. Some patients do well on half or even a quarter of the dose that got them well initially. It's understudied, but the clinical experience suggests it's a viable option for some people.
The therapy helps you find that floor without crashing through it.
The therapy provides the monitoring, the skills, and the early warning system. Medication provides the biological stabilization. Together, they let you titrate down to the minimum necessary intervention rather than the maximum tolerated dose.
I want to ask about one more thing. The prompt mentioned SSRIs specifically, but the combined treatment literature spans different medication classes. Does the therapy plus medication advantage hold across drug types, or is it specific to antidepressants?
It holds across classes, but the evidence base is most developed for depression and anxiety disorders. For bipolar disorder, the picture is different. Medication is essentially non-negotiable, and the role of therapy is to improve medication adherence, manage triggers, and regulate daily rhythms. There's good evidence for family-focused therapy and IPSRT, interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, as adjuncts to mood stabilizers, but nobody is suggesting therapy as a replacement for lithium or valproate.
For psychotic disorders?
CBT for psychosis has a solid evidence base for reducing distress and improving functioning, but it's an adjunct to antipsychotic medication, not a replacement. The idea of using therapy to eliminate medication in schizophrenia is not supported by evidence and would be ethically dubious to suggest.
The therapy as replacement model is really specific to the anxiety-depression spectrum, and even there, it's not universal.
And I think that's where a lot of the public confusion comes from. People hear therapy can reduce the need for medication and extrapolate to all psychiatric conditions. The evidence doesn't support that leap.
Let me shift gears slightly. We've talked about the evidence, the mechanisms, the clinical protocols. What about the patient's subjective experience? Is there research on what it's like to go through this process? The combined treatment, the tapering, the shift from medication to therapy as the primary tool.
Qualitative research on this is growing. There's a 2020 synthesis by Mond and colleagues in The Lancet Psychiatry that looked at patient experiences of discontinuing antidepressants. The themes that emerged were striking. Many patients felt their concerns about withdrawal were dismissed by clinicians. Many described the process as far more difficult than they'd been led to expect. And many felt that the decision to stop medication was framed as a personal failure if it didn't work out.
That last part. The personal failure framing. That's the stigma you mentioned earlier, but from the other direction. You're weak if you take medication, and you're also weak if you try to stop and can't.
It's a double bind. And it's compounded by the fact that most patients receive minimal support during discontinuation. The typical scenario is, patient tells their GP or psychiatrist they want to stop, they're given a brief taper schedule, and then they're on their own. No therapy, no monitoring, no plan for what happens if symptoms return. It's a setup for failure.
Then, when the symptoms return, both patient and doctor conclude that the medication was necessary all along, rather than that the discontinuation process was inadequate.
That's exactly the trap. It's called the discontinuation misinterpretation problem. Symptoms that emerge during or shortly after tapering are assumed to be relapse, the underlying condition returning when they might actually be withdrawal, which is a different phenomenon with a different time course and different implications.
How do you distinguish the two?
Withdrawal symptoms tend to emerge within days to weeks of dose reduction. They often include physical symptoms like dizziness, nausea, and brain zaps. That's the colloquial term for these brief electrical shock sensations, and they typically resolve within weeks if you hold the dose steady. Relapse tends to have a longer time course, weeks to months, and it looks more like the original depressive or anxiety symptoms. But in practice, the distinction can be blurry, and many clinicians don't make it at all.
That's a term I wish I didn't know.
They're real, they're common, and they're under-recognized. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but the leading hypothesis involves serotonin receptor desensitization and the brain's adjustment to lower serotonin tone. They're not dangerous, but they're extremely unpleasant, and they scare people back onto medication unnecessarily.
A slow taper with therapy support isn't just about preventing relapse. It's about managing withdrawal, so that people don't mistake withdrawal for relapse and abandon the attempt prematurely.
And this is where the therapist can play a crucial role that the prescribing physician often can't. The therapist sees the patient weekly or biweekly. They can track symptoms over time, help the patient distinguish withdrawal from relapse, and provide the reassurance and skills to ride out the difficult periods. The physician, in a 15-minute med check, simply can't do that.
This is making me think about the economics of all this. Combined treatment, medication plus weekly therapy, is expensive. Tapering with therapy support takes months. Is there a cost-effectiveness case? Or is this something that only works for people with good insurance?
There is a cost-effectiveness case, and it's stronger than you might expect. The initial combined treatment costs more, no question. But if it prevents relapse, reduces hospitalization, and keeps people functioning and employed, the long-term economics often favor the more intensive upfront investment. NICI has done cost-effectiveness modeling on this, and their guidelines reflect it. The problem is that most healthcare systems are structured around short-term costs, not long-term value. The insurer or health system that pays for the therapy may not be the one that benefits from the reduced hospitalization 5 years later because people switch plans.
The classic misaligned incentives problem.
It's everywhere in healthcare, and mental health is the worst case. The benefits of good mental health treatment accrue across decades and across sectors. Employment, criminal justice, physical health, family stability. But nobody's budget captures all of that.
I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier. The idea that therapy teaches skills that medication doesn't. Is there research that actually measures skill acquisition and ties it to long-term outcomes?
There is, and it's some of the most satisfying research in the field. Studies of CBT for depression have shown that patients who acquire and use cognitive restructuring skills during treatment have lower relapse rates than those who just feel better without acquiring the skills. The same pattern shows up in mindfulness research. Continued meditation practice after MBCT predicts sustained benefit. And in behavioral activation, it's the continued use of activity scheduling and avoidance reduction that maintains the gains.
It's not just that therapy makes you feel better. It's that therapy teaches you how to make yourself feel better, and that capability persists after the session's end.
That's the core insight. And it's why the relapse prevention advantage of therapy over medication exists. When medication stops, the biological support stops. When therapy stops, the skills remain, if they were actually learned and practiced. The challenge is that skill use tends to decline over time without booster sessions or ongoing support.
Which argues for some kind of maintenance therapy, even if it's infrequent.
The evidence on booster sessions is positive, but not overwhelming. A few sessions after treatment ends, spaced out over the following year, seem to help. But the optimal frequency and duration aren't well established. It's another area where the research is suggestive, but not definitive.
We've covered a lot of ground. Let me try to pull together the main threads. Combined treatment outperforms either therapy or medication alone for moderate to severe depression and many anxiety disorders. Sequential treatment. Stabilize on medication, add therapy, then taper medication while continuing therapy, has good evidence for reducing relapse. The mechanism probably involves both skill acquisition and neuroplasticity enhancement. And the practical barriers are substantial. Cost, access to trained therapists, and a healthcare system that isn't set up for integrated treatment.
That's a fair summary. I'd add two things. First, the heterogeneity point. This works differently for different people, and the evidence supports trying it, but not guaranteeing it. Second, the stigma point. The goal should be wellness, not medication freedom as a badge of honor.
The prompt asked whether therapy can reduce or eliminate the need for medication. The answer is yes. It can, for some people, under some conditions, when done well. And for others, the best outcome is lower doses, fewer relapses, and a better life on medication plus therapy. Neither of those is a failure.
And I think the training wheels metaphor, for all its limitations, captures something true. The goal isn't to throw away the training wheels as fast as possible. The goal is to learn to ride in a way that's stable and sustainable, with whatever configuration of supports gets you there.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, the chemist and geologist Abraham Gesner, working in Newfoundland, developed a method for detecting cosmic ray interactions by observing the chemical composition of kerosene distillates. He noticed that certain hydrocarbon fractions fluoresced under specific conditions, a phenomenon later understood to be caused by secondary cosmic ray muons exciting aromatic compounds in the refined oil.
Right. The father of kerosene was also doing accidental particle physics in Newfoundland. That's going to sit with me.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. And if you'd like what we do, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.